This is Taking Aim.
Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Fiction of Healthcare Reform, Part 2, The House Bill. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, clapped her hands as she left the House of Representatives late Saturday night. She had just delivered a healthcare reform bill, H.R. 3962, the America's Affordable Health Choices Act. The Wall Street Journal called it a leviathan. It's twice as long as the Medicare Reform Act of 2003. 1,990 pages, 363,000 words. Dead in the water. That is what the senators are saying. The House bill is dead on arrival in the Senate, Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, said dismissively. Democrats did not line up to challenge him. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, the Democrat from Nevada, has yet to schedule a floor debate, and he hinted last week that senators may not finish health care this year. Ralph?
Maya, the basic issue here is that the bill has been presented as one that concerns advancing health care for the mass and majority of the population. What it does, in fact, is issue what is essentially a license to print money to the drug and insurance industry. U.S. House passes health care bill is an analysis by Kate Randall and World Socialist website, which is actually quite incisive. The bill is the result of months of backroom deals between the Obama administration and representatives of the healthcare industrial lobby. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the total cost of the House plan at $1.055 trillion over a decade, with a net cost of $894 billion after taking into account certain revenues. And indeed, the CBO projects that the bill would lower the federal deficit by $104 billion by 2019. But what it doesn't tell you is that these savings come through deep cuts to federal programs, notably to Medicare. It also includes a mandate that individuals and families have to obtain insurance or pay a penalty, which guarantees that billions of dollars are funneled to the insurance companies in the form of new cash-paying customers. And what is critical to understanding this is that once the population is delivered under penalty to the insurance companies, there is no limit to the premiums that the insurance companies can then charge. It is essentially a license to print money for the drug industry and the insurance companies. The legislation includes a watered-down version of a so-called public option, which would make it available for purchase alongside private insurance plans on an insurance exchange. But unlike under Medicare, where the government sets rates for payments to health care providers, the Secretary of Health and Human Services will have to negotiate rates for payments. The legislation in the House was passed by a very narrow vote, but in the end, the majority for passage was achieved by a very specific ploy, adopting an amendment to the bill that imposes strict bans on the use of federal funds to finance abortion, a medical procedure, as we know, brothers and sisters, legalized nationally in 1973 by the U.S. Supreme Court decision Roe versus Wade. What has happened here is that in a cynical backroom deal with Nancy Pelosi, depending on their vulnerability to the Republican challenges to the 2010 election, they actually engineered that the conservative Democrats would oppose the bill, and then they obtained support for the bill by scuttling abortion rights. More far-reaching than Bush ever attempted to accomplish. It's the anti-abortion amendment, which was advanced by Representative Bart Stupak, the Democrat of Michigan, a fervent abortion opponent, mandates no funds authorized or appropriated by this act may be used to pay for any abortion or to cover any part of the costs of any health plan that includes any coverage of abortion. What this does effectively is to make abortion no longer available to working class or poor women. It bars payment for abortions for women who select a public option or who receive a government subsidy to purchase private insurance. It bans abortions for coverage obtained with assistance from state matching Medicaid funds. To the extent that private employers begin to dump workers into the so-called public option, what it establishes is a long-term effect of drastically eliminating access to abortion for lower-income and working-class women.
Ralph, let's look at the subsidy portion. According to the congressional budget estimates, an individual earning $44,000 a year before taxes would have to pay $5,300 in annual premiums and an estimated $2,000 in out-of-pocket expenses for a total of $7,300 a year, or 17% of his or her pre-tax income. A family earning $102,000 a year before taxes would pay $15,000 in premiums plus $5,300 in out-of-pocket, or $20,300 total. That's 20% of the family's pre-tax income. This is onerous for many families. Let's look at it again. A two-income family with earnings of $102,000, 25% of their expenses usually goes to housing, 25% to taxes. Now 20% going to health care. That's 70% of the income. That's leaving only 30% for everything else. Some of this subsidized by the government, but some of it isn't. A very tough decision for many people. They will find that it is less costly for them to pay the penalty to the government for not having health insurance. And this is exactly what the government is depending on. And it will rely on this money to pay the subsidies for health care coverage. What we have here is an onerous mandate on the American people. Instead of providing true health care coverage, it is creating a new harsh decision for people. I made a chart comparing the House plan with the Senate Finance Committee plan, the Baucus plan. Both plans require most Americans to carry insurance. The House plan stipulates that employers must pay 72% of the insurance plan, or they must pay a penalty. And in the United States, most people receive health insurance through their employment, 67% of people in the United States. The Senate plan doesn't require employers to provide coverage. This is a very important distinction. Medicare cuts are part of both plans, $400 billion over a 10-year period in the House plan. Many of these Medicare cuts are, one, stopping the subsidy to Medicare Advantage, which is the HMO plan. 20% of Medicare recipients utilize this form. Also is a cut in the fees that Medicare assigns to primary care physicians. Ralph?
The abortion issue illuminates precisely the method involved here, and I'm going to just briefly return to this as we elucidate what, in fact, is involved in this concession and in this adaptation to all of the components of the medical industrial complex. Before putting the Stupak Amendment forward for a vote, Pelosi met with pro-choice caucus members. When they saw what she was going to do, when she described what the concessions that would be made, these Democrats who were in favor of abortion rights stormed out. Who lined up in support? The bishops, the Catholic bishops, the American Medical Association, the American Association of Retired Persons, which operates a huge and profitable insurance business, and the drug industry lobby. Despite the ravings of ultra-right Republicans demagogically that the health care restructuring bill is a government takeover of health care, and understand what this is about, because this is the opposite, because this is in fact a vast impauperization of the population and making them virtual servants and slaves of the drug industry and the insurance industry, whose premiums will be even greater than they have been in the past. Consequently, they will then attack the so-called public plan as resulting in these hardships demagogically, when it is the precise opposite. Despite these demagogic representations, the actual meaning of this health care restructuring bill is not a government takeover of health care, but a Wall Street bailout comparable to the takeover of the financial system. The actual health care legislation channels hundreds of billions of dollars into the pockets of the giant insurers and pharmaceuticals through a mandate requiring individuals and families to obtain insurance or face a penalty of up 2.5% of the income. The Congressional Budget Organization's analysis estimates that the House public plan will attract only 6 million people, or one-fifth of the people purchasing insurance. The public option will also only draw the sickest people, who will end up paying vastly higher premiums than those now offered by private insurers. According to the congressional budget estimate, an individual earning $44,000 before taxes will have to pay $5,300 in annual premiums and an estimate $2,000 in out-of-pocket expenses. A family earning $102,000 will pay $15,000 in premiums plus $5,300 out-of-pocket, $20,300 total, 20% of the family's pre-tax income, and that's only the beginning. The posturing by Obama as an advocate of universal health care during his presidential bid now translates into a bill that establishes the right of insurance companies to collect premiums from a captive market, charging what they will. The Congressional Budget Organization estimates that the House bill will leave 18 million people uninsured through 2019, including 6 million immigrants. The Senate Finance Committee version of the legislation leaves 25 million without insurance. There is no guarantee that any so-called permutation of the public option, which will probably not even survive the Senate plan, will result in anything public whatsoever. It is essentially a license for the insurance companies and drug companies to increase their premiums at will to a captive public, forced penalty and fine to hand themselves over to this private operation.
Ralph, the insurance coverage that people would be able to afford are ones that will have very high deductibles. Let's look at the actual cost of insurance that employers are paying today. For Kaiser, for instance, high quality health maintenance organization, for a person in their 30s, the rate is about $325 a month. That's $3,900 a year. But as you get older, Kaiser charges more. So that for me, at 62 years of age, the rate is $850 a month, or $10,200 a year. And co-payments, and a large co-payment should hospitalization be required. Any plan that has a very high deductible requiring people to pay $2,000, $3,000, up to $5,000 before that insurance plan kicks in is really all that's going to be available to most of the population. Let's return to the differences, because the senators are saying that this House plan that is being touted will not pass, and a much more onerous plan will be available. A feature of the House plan is a $140 billion drug discount, while the Senate plan has an $80 billion drug discount over 10 years that had been negotiated with the Obama administration. On our last program, we started to discuss the $80 billion discount over 10 years, which might look like a lot of money, but actually is just a drop in the bucket for the pharmaceutical industry. It had been negotiated by Billy Towson, who was a former Republican congressman, before that a Democratic congressman, and he's the head of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, PhRMA. That is the trade group. As he said, We were assured we needed somebody to come in first. If you come in first, you'll have a rock solid deal. And that is what Towson provided with Senator Max Baucus. The pharmaceutical industry generates in the United States alone more than $300 billion of sales each year. So $8 billion is 2.6% of that. The House bill calling for a $140 billion discount over 10 years would be 4.6%. But the $80 billion has been agreed to by the White House. This is offset by the increased profits that the pharmaceutical industry stands to make on prescriptions that will be purchased by the new patients under the health insurance coverage. An analysis by the U.S. Committee on Government Reform found that in the first 6 months of Medicare Part D, that is the drug program, it generated $8 billion in profits for the pharmaceutical company. And a Kaiser Family Foundation study estimated that Medicare Part D generated $724 billion in revenues between 2006 and 2015. It's interesting to note that the person who had a very key role in guiding Medicare Part D through Congress was none other than Billy Towson, who was then chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee from 2001 to the beginning of 2004. And Senator Baucus, who is now the person who has guided the outstanding Senate bill through the Finance Committee, he also was a key author of Medicare Part D. Most interesting, the most significant aspect of the Medicare Part D legislation, and that would become part of the new health care so-called reform legislation, is that Medicare cannot have bulk negotiations with the drug companies. Let's look at Medicare. On Medicare, the Medicare Administration sets fees. And these are the fees that doctors must accept. Hospitals and the doctors write down for their Medicare patients from their retail price down to the Medicare, and that is what they accept. This is not allowed for Medicare Part D. But even going further, the government cannot even have bulk negotiations with the pharmaceutical companies. Ralph.
Maya, the Cadillac health care plan has to be examined carefully. The top White House economic advisor stated that cutting health care was the key to addressing the federal budget deficit, and that taxing the so-called Cadillac health care plan was an essential part of restructuring the system. Speaking before the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., Christina Romer, chairperson of the Council on Economic Advisers, stated, quote, "It is fiscally irresponsible not to do health care reform. To bury our head in the sand for even one more year and pretend that the problem of rising government health care expenditure will go away is simply untenable," unquote. In short, what the entire thrust of this so-called Health Care Reform Act is to slash, cut, and undermine government support for health care and to ascribe to the health care program a threat to the financial stability of the country. Not the $50 trillion that have been given to U.S. and European banks. Not the vast trillions that go to permanent war. Not the super profits through speculation on the zero interest rate on the U.S. currency that is now resulting in a fever of future speculations in derivatives exactly like that which created the great crash before and which is going to fuel an even greater crash in the immediate future. None of that. No, it's health care which presents a threat to the stability of the system. Quote, "To bury our head in the sand for even one more year and pretend that the problem of rising government health care expenditures will go away is untenable." What these remarks highlighted is the fact that the Obama administration's view of overhauling the U.S. health care system is based not on expanding or improving care for millions of ordinary Americans, but on slashing government spending and vastly escalating the profits of the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies. Let's examine this more closely. Senate Democrats, in close cooperation with the White House officials, who have been working to reconcile health care legislation adopted by two Senate panels, the Finance and Health Committee. And all of this is involved in endorsing the Baucus plan, as you were describing it, Maya. And it's not just the Baucus plan. You mentioned Bausen. Bausen is one of the principal touts for the lobbyists for the drug industry, the insurance industry. Touted as a tax aimed at an elite segment of the population, in fact, unionized employees are amongst the largest holders of those policies, the so-called Cadillac plans, which they now want to tax at a 40% rate. These plans, which offer generous coverage and lower deductibles, were obtained through bitter labor struggles in contract disputes, often by accepting deduction in wages and other benefits in order to gain a better health care plan through negotiations with employers. So now what they want to do is to gut that. That's what the Baucus plan is really about. The taxes on these plans would be levied against insurance companies, who will then pass these costs and more onto the insured employees through raised premiums and reduced coverage. In fact, the entire operation is an essential declaration of war on what they call Cadillac health care plans, which is to say health care plans that are more advantageous to the workers who have them. A policy along these lines is designed effectively to reduce health care coverage and increase profits. There is no ambiguity about that. In the New York Times on November 7th, there was a headline, "Fundraising Adds to Pressures on Health Care." It's interesting that on the Internet, brothers and sisters, they modified that headline. It's no longer the fundraising that the Democrats are doing that accounts for their sellout on health care. It says Pelosi faces competing pressures. Accompanying Pelosi on her U.S. Airways flight in her political fundraising tour was the most prominent health care lobbyist, Frederick Grave, who represents medical equipment companies and the drug companies and the industry. He enlisted health industry executives to a fundraising dinner. And indeed, they were the centerpiece of the call for a healthcare overhaul, a muscular government-run insurer. So in essence, the fox is guarding the chicken coop here, as always. They raised $100,000 for Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. There were 40 donors. A trial lawyer, Stuart Garson, who calls the public option a sellout. It is a microcosm, the article in the Times continues, of what Pelosi is doing to steer the health care overall through the House. Traveling to raise money every weekend, she is engaged with health industry lobbyists who are increasing their contributions to maintain their access to her, the Times describes, and to shape the bill. She is effectively presenting herself as an advocate of health care reform while acting as a shill for the people who are literally paying her money from the health industry and the drugs. Their lobbying pressure is already at a maximum, so to have at them much in the nest in terms of fundraising only adds to our concerns, writes the New York Times. The industry lobbyists, speaking on condition of anonymity, state they have stepped up their fundraising for Pelosi all year with an eye to her pivotal role in the healthcare endgame, staying in her good graces to shape the outcome, writes the New York Times.
Ralph, the New York Times is specific. Individuals connected to the industry have given her already $210,000. This is for her own campaign fund this year, and this data comes from the Center for Responsive Politics. This is compared with a total of $280,000 in the 2 years before the 2008 election, so it's double. and 87,000 in the 2 years before the 2006 election, and less than 50,000 in the cycle before that. So that you can see that as her power as House Majority Leader has risen, so have the contributions from the health care lobby. Ms. Pelosi has courted health care lobbyists, writes The Times. At an April 26th breakfast, she collected five checks from groups representing for-profit hospitals, radiologists, internists, and gynecologists. This is money that is repeated over and again. And when we talk about the contributions from, let's say, a healthcare company, then you have to add the individual contributions from the individuals within that company. Checks from political action committees representing not only for-profit hospital, but also nurses, cardiologists, Medco, which is a drug benefit manager, and the drug makers Amgen and Johnson & Johnson. Ralph?
Well, Maya, in the New York Times on November 9th, the relationship between the medical industrial complex and the Democrats is very clear. The headline is, "The Medical Industry Grumbles, But It Stands to Gain," by Duff Wilson and Reed Abelson. For any industry, there has to be good news any time Congress votes to expand their market by tens of millions of customers. The business world found plenty to complain about Sunday as it assessed a House bill that makes sweeping changes in the health care system and extends insurance coverage to millions of more Americans. Drug makers making billions of dollars in rebates, makers of artificial hips, heart defibrillators, and medical devices are not happy about a proposed 2.5% tax on their products. However, what they are understanding is that they will be able to increase their charges and their premiums by much larger amounts. All industries stands to gain from this legislation, Stephen D. Finley, senior health analyst with Consumers Union, stated. They are going to fight for their narrow issues, but they stand to gain vast new business and revenue streams from this from the coverage that is imposed upon the participants. New revenue streams apply only to companies in the business of selling medical goods and services, the drug industry, the insurers. This won't hurt business. It will hurt the millions of workers who have coverage through their employers, said John J. Castellani. The National Federation of Independent Businesses representing small businesses stated that the legislation was a failed opportunity to help small business owners while benefiting the large members of the medical industrial complex. The current House legislation fails to bend the health cost curve and breaks the promise that those who need current coverage will be able to maintain it. So what we're really looking at here is a sellout.
We will return after a brief station identification. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Fiction of Healthcare Reform, Part 2, the House Bill.
Well, Maya, look at this carefully. The New York Times calls it a victory for the biotechnology drug industry. The House bill gives biotech drugs, which can cost tens of thousands of dollars a year, protection from any generic competition. That means that people can't get generic drugs anymore at lower costs, let alone drugs from Canada or any other place, which are a fraction of the inflated cost of these arbitrarily gouged prices that the drug industry and the pharmaceutical industry imposes. That's at the heart of this. In fact, I think it's appropriate at this point, Maya, to look at the main Obama advisor, who has been the architect of much of all of this, Ezekiel J. Emanuel, who is the brother of Rahm Emanuel, the close advisor to the Obama administration on issues of health care, serving as the special advisor of health policy to the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget and chair of the Department of Bioethics of the Clinical Center of the National Institute of Health, In March, Emmanuel was appointed to the Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research, the 15-member body authorized by Obama's American Recovery and Reinvestment Act to provide, quote, information on the relative strengths and weaknesses of various medical interventions in relation to federal programs. So here you really have, if you like, the gray eminence, the sinister figure, the brother of Rahm Emanuel, who has been orchestrating all this. He pledged to slash more than $600 billion from Medicare and Medicaid as part of this plan. Using comparative effectiveness research, they recommended cuts in the form of cost-cutting efficiencies to federal programs for the elderly, the disabled, and the poor. In fact, the cuts were central to Obama's health care plan and in all versions of legislation that were present before the Congress. For decades, efforts to slash Medicare benefits had been frustrated by political opposition from the working class and senior citizens. The appointment of this body under Ezekiel Emanuel was a thoroughly anti-democratic effort to ride roughshod over popular opposition to the deep cuts that impact the health and lives of many millions of Americans. Ezekiel Emanuel, the brother of White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, was placed in the strategic position to shape the Obama administration's plans. It's worth looking at Emanuel's vision of health care because it reveals that the Obama proposals have been informed by Emanuel's guiding principles. Among them are defense of a health system based on private property and the delivery of a class-based and rationed medical care according to income for the majority of Americans. Opponents of Obama's health care initiatives have attacked Emanuel for writings in which he advocated rationing care, notably for the elderly and for infants and those with mental or physical disabilities. Emanuel states, "It is necessary to ensure access to finite and limited health care resources only to productive segments of society." This is almost Nazi-like. Many of the attacks on Emanuel have taken note on his shameless arguing that those who are most vulnerable should not be entitled to health care at all. In a recent article appearing in the January 2009 Lancet, he spells out his attitude towards, quote, "limiting scarce medical resources for the elderly. Unlike allocation by sex or race, allocation by age is not invidious discrimination." He writes, "Every person lives through different life stages rather than being a single age." He says adolescents should receive care at the expense of infants. Adolescents have received substantial education and parental care and investments that would be wasted. Infants, by contrast, have not received these investments, so it is much worse if an adolescent dies than if a three-year-old child dies. You understand what we're talking about here? Deciding who dies and who is to be deprived of health care on the basis of how you allocate resources that are designed to be limited and designed to exclude whole sections of the population by category from the entitlement to health care.
Ralph, it goes further. Emanuel argues that medical services must be restricted for the general population, as you say, unless, of course, the individual can pay extra for them. For instance, he writes, men with early-stage prostate cancer can choose radiation therapy, might have no copayment for three-dimensional conformal radiation, but might have to cover the marginal cost if they want more expensive intensity-modulated radiation therapy. He goes on, a costly treatment for metastatic colon cancer, which can prolong life, he bemoans the fact that Medicare pays for two cancer drugs, Erbitux, which is $40,000 per patient, and Avastin, $50,000 per patient. But he does not question the astronomical prices that the pharmaceutical companies are charging for these drugs. Consider this, $40,000 for drug treatment, $50,000 for drug treatment. Consider what it would be like if we had true public health care, true public financing of drug treatment, true public financing of preventive health care, true public health care. health care where doctors, nurses, and the hospitals are public. They're public employees, publicly owned, publicly provided. When everybody has health care, consider that. $40,000 for drugs, $50,000 for drugs, and the research for these drugs is usually publicly subsidized. Ralph?
He has a means of financing his plan through a dedicated 10% value-added tax, or VAT, on purchase and services, which he calls egalitarian. Well, value-added tax is highly regressive as a form of taxation because it disproportionately targets lower-income people. Healthcare expenditures under Emanuel's plan, which has been incorporated into these Obama schemes, would be capped according to the amount of revenue raised by the VAT. Emanuel calls for an outright end to employer-based healthcare provision, which eliminates any responsibility for businesses to provide medical insurance for their employees. Among unionized workers, healthcare coverage, which had been won in the course of decades of bitter struggle, is to be scrapped. Emanuel will scrap these benefits and replace them with a plan providing standard benefits. It's no accident that Ezekiel Emanuel won the unbridled praise of Steve Miller, the CEO of Delphi Corporation, who led the attack on wages and benefits of auto workers. Miller is quoted on the front page of Emanuel's book saying, "I wish I had a magic wand to make Emanuel's plan happen." Big business is delighted with the mandate to dub insurance coverage for employees. So Obama's proposal, which are essentially reflecting Ezekiel Emanuel's schemes, go a long way towards dismantling employer-provided health care. Obama stated that he would support, under the Senate Finance Committee plan, a model for eventual health care reform, which is to say that employers who fail to provide medical insurance or eliminate existing coverage will be required to pay only a nominal penalty, which is a fraction of the cost of the premium. So it is in the company's financial interest to pay the fee and drop the coverage. That's exactly the drug industry's agenda. And it puts the lie to the demagogy of Obama during the campaign, which said if you like your insurance, you can keep it. The opposite is true. Under Emanuel's plan, everyone will have the so-called same standard plan, and the wealthy will be able to purchase the real care. And here's how he justifies this. We are used to being able to spend our money on what we want. If we want a fancier car, a small, faster computer with more memory, or a luxury vacation, we pay the extra cost for such things and skimp somewhere else if necessary. That is the key to our decision. You see, if you, as Anatole France famously wrote in the end of the 19th century, workers and the bankers have the equal right and freedom to sleep under a bridge.
Ralph, I'd like to return to something you were discussing, which is the penalties. The Congressional Budget Office, which is considered nonpartisan, estimated in its study of the House health care bill that it would bring in $167 billion over 10 years, $16.7 billion a year in penalties from those who either opt out and instead of having insurance coverage, or the companies, the employers who are dropping the coverage. In other words, they are choosing to not provide their employees with health coverage where they're paying at least over 72% of the cost of that coverage. It relies on $33 billion coming from individuals and $134 billion coming from the employers, that is, people paying fines. And according to the House bill, on your income tax statement, you must provide proof that you have health insurance. That would be part of the obligation. And this is insurance from an authorized, government-authorized insurance company, and there is going to be a division of the government that decides who is an authorized, what is an authorized company and what isn't an authorized company. And that means that you are going against the law. You can have criminal penalties if you don't provide proof that you have health insurance or if you're not paying the fine. So this is quite onerous. And think about that. The government is counting for, in its estimates, to pay for this program on people not having health insurance. I'd like to look at another aspect of the House bill, something that goes to what you were discussing with Ezekiel Manuel. And the House bill, this is something that was revealed by the Wall Street Journal in its article, What the Pelosi Healthcare Bill Really Says. And the Wall Street Journal has been doing a slam on healthcare reform, even though it's the insurance companies who are going to benefit. They're apparently not benefiting enough for even the Wall Street Journal, which, of course, has supported the entire financial giveaway to the banks, the banksters. The Wall Street Journal points out that in the healthcare bill, there is a provision about Medicare. And this is the old gatekeeper program. It's called the medical home. And they call it this decade's version of the new HMO restrictions on care, wherein a primary care provider will manage access to specialists and diagnostic tests for a flat monthly fee. Medicare, as I mentioned before, general Medicare, is a fee-per-service program. But the bill specifies that patients would have to settle for a nurse practitioner instead of a physician sometimes as their primary care provider, or their primary care provider will be provided with a monthly fee, a flat fee, for handling their care. So whether or not they see that person, they get paid. And so the fewer times they see someone, the more money they're going to make off of that person. This is a pilot program at first, but it can be extended by the health department of the United States. And this is very important because the medical home is, again, a version of the gatekeepers that 20 years ago was considered a cost control priority. Ralph?
Well, at one point, Ezekiel Emanuel writes in his advisories to Obama, can we chalk up our problems to the greedy pharmaceutical industry and blood-sucking insurance companies? A resounding no. His program is then built around maintaining the healthcare giants, boosting their profits, and dismembering Medicare and Medicaid. The hostility to Medicare reflected in Emanuel's program and in Obama's legislation has existed within sections of the ruling class since its enactment. It was a concession extracted from mass struggles of the working class. It's bound up with opposition to any program expressing even a limited way egalitarian forms of social organization. And what this really comes down to is the following, brothers and sisters, with this whole charade about revised and universal health care is about is the following. In this crisis of late capitalism, the American ruling class cannot tolerate, under the prevailing conditions of rabid economic decline, a principle that all elderly people, regardless of economic status, are entitled to health care equivalent to that of the rich. On the contrary, they are now demanding that health care, like education and schooling and all aspects of social life, will be placed on a direct class basis to bring it in line with the vast growth of social inequality and an effective dictatorship of the financial aristocracy. These policies are part of a restructuring of American capitalism and of class relations in the United States under the pretext of addressing an economic crisis, in this case that of health care. What we're looking at is a vast campaign to lower permanently the living standards of working people. And that's what underlies the drug lobby's demands and success in obtaining Obama's pledge to protect their profits, which is at the heart of this entire House legislation and will be deepened and amplified by the Senate. Maya?
Yes. Ralph, I want to return to the cost for low and middle income people in having insurance. As I said, the extension of Medicaid to 150% of poverty level is an advantage if this takes place. The downside is that many doctors opt out of providing care to Medicaid patients because they consider the fees too low. This is also happening with Medicare. Many doctors refuse to accept Medicare patients because they know that they're going to get so much more money from private insurers for the remuneration for the services provided. Under the House bill, the Congressional Budget Office reported, and this is something I discussed before, but I think we have to reiterate it because it shows how much income is going to be siphoned off from people, particularly young people who don't use medical care that much, but who should have medical coverage, but they can't afford it. And they're still going to not be able to afford it. A family of four with income of $78,000 in 2016 would pay on the average an annual premium of $8,800 and co-payments of $5,000 for a total of $13,800, or equivalent to 18% of the family's income. A family of four with making $90,000 $90,100 total could also receive subsidies. It would still have to pay $11,000 in premiums, $5,500 in cost sharing, for a total of $16,600 or 18% of family income. For lower income people, the subsidies are more general. A family with an income of $66,000 would pay premiums of $6,300 and cost sharing of $3,700 for a total of $10,000 or 15% of its income. The outlay for people is still more than they can afford. And you have to recall that health insurance doesn't cover everything. Most health insurance doesn't cover optical care, doesn't cover dental care, doesn't cover chiropractic or acupuncture or other alternative treatments. It is, for the most part, catastrophic care when you get high write-offs each year. Ralph?
Well, the New York Times made these things extremely clear. I must say that the reporting in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, if you don't rely on the political interpretation but just the data reflected there, is devastating. The New York Times reported that the White House has acknowledged it made a deal with the drug makers to block moves in Congress to obtain any cost saving beyond the $80 billion that the pharmaceutical lobby designated. The New York Times stipulates that in return for the $80 billion agreement, the Obama administration blocked any health care legislation that would allow the government to negotiate price setting on drugs. And as the Times describe it, is evidence of the corporate forces calling the shots in Obama's health care overhaul. The plan will make the health care giants essentially huge profit makers. Let's look at how this actually works. The Times report, by the way, describes a deal that was between Baucus and Towson, who met twice with Rahm Emanuel, the White House chief of staff, with Messina, his deputy, and with Nancy Andapal, the aide overseeing the healthcare overhaul, to confirm the administration's acceptance of the pharmaceutical industry's term. Towson said the White House blessed the deal. Now, let's remember something here. Towson earned his stripes as the big heavy for the big pharmaceuticals during his entire career in Congress and is now a lobbyist for these same forces. He is a lobbyist for the major pharmaceutical and insurance companies. And the details about the pharmaceuticals' $80 billion are extremely revealing because what the $80 billion is pegged to is a formulation that will allow them to increase their charges to the point where they will make something like $800 billion. So this is a ploy. It is a pharmaceutical industry ploy. It is a shameless scam in order to rip off the public that is going to be subject to penalty of fine if they don't buy into a program where the premiums and the cost will create such vast profits for the industry that the nominal cuts are only a loss leader.
Ralph, again, we have for the Medicaid insurers, many of counties and states require people in Medicaid to go into HMOs and the health maintenance organizations. And Medicaid at one time was a fee-for-service, and now they require people to enroll in these HMOs. Bloomberg, the financial analysis online and reporting agency, had an article on September 11th by Alex Nussbaum. Pelosi's, quote, immoral insurers may gain in Obama's plan. And they note that for each Medicaid enrollee, they generate $200 a month and a 3% profit margin for these Medicaid HMOs. Medicaid insured 58.7 million people in 2006. It was hallelujah for the Medicaid HMOs. It writes, Medicaid seems to be the only managed care subsector that is politically protected and the only group with who's going to have significant benefits from reform, said one of the spokespeople for the Medicaid HMOs. However, it is the, as you noted, the pharmaceutical industry and also the other insurance companies that are going to benefit. They are not the only ones who benefit. But let's look at some of these Medicaid HMOs. Centene and WellCare each would increase earnings per share by 1.2%, and AMA Group, another Medicaid HMO, by 1%, said an analyst of the financial analyst of these Medicaid HMOs. As I said before, each enrollee generates $200 a month with a 3% profit margin. So this is significant. And as Bloomberg says, these companies are showing their stocks rising with the advent of this new Medicaid legislation. Ralph.
My Dr. Marcia Angel, writing for Yahoo News and in the Huffington Post, raises the question, is the House health care bill better than nothing? Well, the House health care bill, a reform bill known to Republicans as the government takeover, finally passed. Two stalwarts of the single-payer movement split their votes. John Conyers voted for it. Kucinich voted against. Kucinich was right. Conservative rhetoric notwithstanding, the House bill is not a government takeover. It enshrines and subsidizes the takeover by the investor-owned insurance industry. And indeed, it provides for the free reign of an industry that is profiteering at a staggering rate. What does the insurance industry get out of it? Tens of millions of new customers, courtesy of the mandate and taxpayer subsidies, not just any kind of customer. The youngest, healthiest customers least likely to use their insurance, and it allows the insurers to charge twice as much for older people. So older under 65s will go without insurance, even if they have to pay the fine, and that's fine with the industry, since these would be among their sickest customers. It's very well expressed by Chris Hedges, brothers and sisters, in an article entitled, It's Robbery. Healthcare proposals in Congress are a ripoff, not reform. The current healthcare debate in Congress has nothing to do with death panels or public options or socialized medicine. The real debate, and the only one that counts, is how much money these blood-sucking insurance, pharmaceuticals, and for-profit health services can siphon off from the new healthcare legislation. The plans in Congress ensure that the profits for these corporations will increase and the misery for ordinary Americans will be compounded. The corporate state, enabled by Democrats and Republicans, is yet again cannibalizing the Treasury, pushing Americans, especially the poor and the working class, into levels of despair and rage. The Democrats have collaborated with the lobbyists for the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and for-profit health care providers to provide a ripoff of the public at large. It is not a race to the top. It is a race to the bottom.
It is a race to the bottom for all of us until we remove permanently those at the top.
This has been Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenemann
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Fiction of Healthcare Reform, Part 2, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be preempted next week for a fun drive of the Pacifica Archives, and we will return the week afterwards. We'll be back with you then. Looking forward to having you listen to Taking Aim. Tatanta, Tinaparo, Tatanta, Philo, Tokmi, Walanga, Mandal.